From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 15,000 last week and kept on going with record-high numbers. Americans left the stock market in droves after the searing losses of 2007 and 8. Now millions have their little nest eggs, dreams, retirement bundles, sitting, earning next to nothing. So what about stocks? Are they saying recovery or bubble or something else? This hour on Point, we're looking at Wall Street. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you in the market? Does it still look like crazy country to you? Or promising, even now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will look at actress Angelina Jolie's decision at 37 to have a double mastectomy to cut her inherited risk of cancer. Big story for many people in many people's own lives. But first, to the markets. Here's the closing bell from the New York Stock Exchange last Tuesday, May 7th, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average first closed above 15,000. And here's market analyst Deborah Borchardt of The Street TV, a digital financial media company, on the floor of the stock exchange on Friday, May 3rd, when the Dow first hit but didn't close at 15,000.
Wow, this market is rocking. We got those non-farm payrolls results, and they liked what they saw, sending the market to Dow 15,000 for the first time. S&P going to, well, we're at 1616 right now.
Same day, here's Keith Bliss at the brokerage company Catone speaking to The Street TV about taking risks in the current market.
Listen, you've either been out of the market and you miss it, or you've tried to short the market and get your face ripped off. We saw a little bit of that this morning as well. The fact of the matter is that we've been going up, and you either get on and hop along for the ride or you miss it.
Joining me now from New York is Stephen Russolillo, market reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Stephen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
How are people interpreting this now quite big run-up over the last couple of years? What's going on?
Yeah, so I think Mr. Bliss's comments there really tell exactly what's happening, is that the market just keeps going up, and it's defying a lot of the logic out there that says that maybe it shouldn't be going as fast as it is. But nevertheless, the velocity behind this market is hard to ignore right now, and you're either on board or you're not. And so I think the big story here of 2013 with the Dow above 15,000 right now is the market has had quite a run right here, and people are finally starting to realize that and finally starting to enter the market. So you talked about how billions and billions of dollars have poured out of the market following the financial crisis. Well, really over the past few months is really the only time that we've started to see the individual investors start to put money back into the market. And so the argument can be made, is the little guy getting in too late? Well, maybe, maybe not. And so there are conflicting signals going on. You have an economy that is slowly but surely starting to improve, and we're seeing that in the jobs numbers. You're seeing that in the housing market. And you also have a very, very accommodative Federal Reserve that is buying bonds, and they have very, very easy money policies in place right now that are intended to lower the unemployment rate and also just to boost the economy. So a lot of people call this sort of the Goldilocks scenario of an economy that is not growing too much but not falling into a recession, where it's kind of sort of stuck in this point where the Fed can keep doing what it's doing, and you add all of that together, and that is good for stock prices.
What about the Fed's sway and role here, Stephen? Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, has been very explicit in his desire to drive people into the stock market, into equities. How has the Fed's path in the last couple of years helped to do that?
Yeah, so the Fed has kept interest rates at rock bottom. The Fed is stimulating the economy by buying $85 billion worth of bonds every single month right now, and they have signaled that they can raise or lower that level depending on economic conditions. And the Fed has said that they're not going to even consider raising rates until the unemployment rate gets back to 6.5%, which the economy is very, very far from that level right now. So if you believe that the Fed has been a big driver of the market's big rally over the past few years, then there is little reason to think that anything's going to be different going forward if the Fed is going to continue doing what it's doing. Now, that is a big question. And there was a story in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend talking about how the Fed is mapping out its exit strategy right now from all these easy money policies. And so Fed officials are talking about the next step in this. And the big question on the street that everybody's asking right now is, okay, if the Fed starts pulling back, if the Fed gets a little bit more hawkish, if the Fed changes its tune just a little bit, what will that mean for stock prices? And depending on who you talk to, some people, that could be a big turning point in the market. Other people say, well, the Fed is only going to change tune because the economy is getting better. And so an economy getting better should be good for stocks. So that is really the central question that's on people's minds right now.
You know, a whole lot of people are still not in the stock market, and maybe they shouldn't be. But the alternatives have left people, you know, retired people living on fumes because interest rates are so low. People trying to save for anything, retirement included, with almost no interest rate they can grab onto. So that I have a feeling people may be looking right now and saying, well, oh, that was painful before, but should I? Do I have to? Is this a sucker's time to come in, Stephen?
Right. So what we've seen, it's a great point. What we've seen is that the defensive-minded stocks, a lot of the high-paying dividend stocks, have outperformed in this market. And I think that that's a telling sign of how people feel and what their mindset is about this market right now. Because when you see a big bull market, the Dow is up 130-140% off the March 2009 lows. I mean, these are humongous numbers here. But it's not the cyclical growth story stocks that are leading the way. It's more of the defensive-minded stocks. It's the stocks like Procter & Gamble and stocks that typically don't outperform when the economy is booming, but they're stocks that people buy because they are safer, they have high dividend payouts, and they're considered to be less risky. And so that is a signal to a lot of people that this market, the growth story behind this rally here is not totally the same as you would typically see in a normal bull market, perhaps of the 90s or even the 80s. And so to get to your point, what are people doing here? Are they feeling left out? Well, I think the trend that we've seen so far is that dividend paying stocks are the way to go. And you have a lot of analysts now that are saying, okay, the dividend players have done well. Now it's time for perhaps the other growthier stocks to start outperforming. But those calls have been happening for quite some time now, so we'll see on that front. But definitely a key characteristic of this market is just how defensive-minded the rally has really been.
The growthier stocks. Is that what you said? Is that like truthier? That's great. We're in Colbert country. Hey, what about fundamentals? I mean, let's remember that these are all-time high numbers, but in absolute terms, not just numerical terms, I guess, what about the fundamentals? It's not all-time highs. But help clear that up for us.
Right. So you look at the job market. Just recently have the monthly employment figures started to look a little bit better than people had been anticipating. And so, but you still need to see those numbers get even better just to keep up with population growth, let alone seeing a significant drop in the unemployment rate. So yes, you're right. It seems like, at least if you're just looking at the labor market, the stock market has certainly gotten ahead of the fundamentals in what we're seeing in that part of the economy. The housing market continues to improve, and that was a big story in 2012 and has continued into this year. But you have to remember that the housing market is coming off of really, really rock bottom levels. So if you believe that the trajectory will continue to be higher, there could be a lot more room for improvement when it comes to housing, but bouncing off the bottom isn't such a great feat when it comes to housing because it fell so far. And other metrics, wage growth is still very low. People's take-home pays, barely keeping up with inflation at this point. So when you look at the underlying economic fundamentals here, they don't necessarily jive with a market that is at record highs. But again, the reason why the market is where it is partly because of the Fed, partly because of the rest of the world. Perhaps people think that U.S. is in a better position than the rest of the world. So a lot of reasons why there's this disconnect here between stocks and the economy. But another thing to consider also is that even when you see these record high numbers in the Dow, the S&P 500, even in other markets like the Russell 2000, that's a small cap index, the market still is not considered to be overly expensive. And so if you're looking at price to earnings ratios, that's a valuation mm-hmm. metric that people really follow. The market is pretty evenly priced right now. It's not expensive. It's not cheap either. And so for bulls, that's a reason to think that the market could keep going higher here, even if the economic fundamentals are still lagging what the market has to offer.
Stephen Russolillo, covering the markets for the Wall Street Journal in New York. Thank you very much, Stephen, for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to bring Alan Saini in right now. We'll get a couple of perspectives in this hour. Alan's with me in the studio, founder, president, chief global economist at Decision Economics. Alan, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
So here's one of our listeners online. 29er says, what's fueling the market? Let the Fed remove the crack pipe, even for a month, and find out the answer. He says everything's going to be rainbows and butterflies right up until the day it won't be. Many leveraged bulls stampeding through a very small door. This listener says it's all about that the Fed floating this thing up on all that QE, quantitative easing and bond buying. What do you think, Alan?
They don't take the medicine for this listener, the drug away, until the economy is on its own doing very, very well. Then they can take it away. And if the economy is producing good earnings with still low interest rates, the stock market will be fine.
So this could have legs. Even at 15,000, this all-time high number, you still see upside?
Oh, absolutely. I think the best is yet to come. This does have legs, and it's fundamentally rooted in the macroeconomics of the expansion in the U.S. and of the world, which is getting another injection of support and stimulus from central banks all over the world. Asset prices go up in anticipation of future better activity. And if history's any guide, they will eventually get their way. Economies will do better, the U.S., Japan, China. Earnings will keep on going up. Interest rates will still be low. They may be a little higher, but they'll still be low. And the stock market prices, earnings, and interest rates, the stock market keeps going up, repeated new highs, occasional corrections for quite some time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the message and the all-time high stock market numbers, whether they say recovery or bubble or something else. Warren Buffett on last Monday, May 6th, on CNBC's Squawk Box, the Oracle of Omaha, talked about how his expectations for stocks over time play out as the Dow was headed for record highs.
Probably in my lifetime, and certainly in your lifetime, you know, you will see markets that are far higher than this. I mean, the retention of earnings by American industry, the growth of the country, but will cause stocks to go higher over time. You're not getting everything out of stocks in terms of the dividends they pay compared to the earnings, so that retention builds it up.
Warren Buffett there. And what about Ben Bernanke, Fed chair, who's driving a lot of what's going on here? Here he was on Friday at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago talking about the Fed's role in monitoring the financial markets.
Even if we can't identify, and I'm fully willing to admit that there will be times when we can't identify a bubble or some other misvaluation, our hope is to make sure that the system itself is sufficiently robust that if there is a problem, that it won't be amplified into a major systemic crisis.
Alan Sinai is with us, President, Chief Global Economist at Decision Economics, with me in the studio. He's pretty optimistic, looking in a kind of sunny way, and he doesn't always at the market right now. With us from New York is Michael Pento, president of Pento Portfolio Strategies, an investment advisory firm in New Jersey, author of The Coming Bond Market Collapse, How to Survive the Demise of the U.S. Debt Market. Michael Pento, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what do you see out there on the market?
Well, I agree that you should be buying stocks now, but I am a very nervous buyer because the market is healing ostensibly, but it's 100% completely artificially engendered. We have a consumption bubble created by transfer payments, $1 trillion plus deficits each of the last 4 years. Everybody's talking now about our deficit coming down significantly, but it's still going to be about $850 billion. It was around $250 billion before the Great Recession began in 2007. By the way, most of those deficits are printed and monetized by our Federal Reserve. We have 0% interest rates since the end of 2008. Debt service relief on the part of the private and public sectors has engendered and reinflated stock and even real estate bubbles. And our earnings on the S&P 500 are supported by this free money. If you look at revenue growth, it's just not there. So I'm a nervous buyer of this market, but it's going to end, and it's going to end very badly.
Well, what about the notion that underneath or behind or alongside all that pumped in money and everything else you described there, Michael, the recovery is gradually recovering, and when the punch bowl's taken away, it'll be up and running.
Well, this is fantasy, Tom. This is complete fantasy. First of all, let me dispute the fact that the recession, according to the NBER, the recession ended in the summer of 2009. So let's fast forward to now where we are in Q2 2013. Let's look at some latest numbers. Let's talk about the recovery in real estate. Why is it that the home ownership rate is now at 65% at the end of Q1 2013? Mm-hmm. That's a 17-year low. If the housing market was on stable and viable footing, wouldn't you believe that first-time home buyers and owner-occupiers would be buying these houses? Let's quickly switch to the jobs report. If we're really creating a lot of good and stable jobs in this economy, why is it that there were 9,000 goods-producing jobs lost in April? Why was it that there were zero manufacturing jobs created in April? Why was it that aggregate hours worked fell by 0.4% from March to April? So I can make a big argument here saying that the economy is doing okay, just okay, but it's all artificial. And when the Fed removes this, the training wheels from the economy, and I don't believe they'll be able to do it, but when and if they ever were to do it, we're going to fall right back to where we were in the fall of 2008, and that is headed towards a deflationary depression.
That sounds like hell. Alan Sinai, what do you say to that analysis?
Well, that's interesting, Michael. I just don't agree with it at all in a number of dimensions, including the technical economics, which would kind of bore the listeners if I got into that. Fundamentally, for us and for me, what I am seeing is very familiar. It's kind of what you see in a recession where central banks ease money by lowering interest rates, and then asset prices respond, and then they have effects on the economy. We also get lower inflation during a recession. Lower inflation helps purchasing power. And with lag, sometimes very long, economic activity picks up. The labor market then lags that and gets better. And later on, you get price inflation that comes from the business cycle. This is a long process. The interesting thing about this situation, which really is very different from a lot of times in history, is we're going through a repeat of this process now, motivated by central banks using the balance sheets to expand their holdings on the balance sheet, which have the same effects as cutting interest rates to, if they could have, below zero, which we needed to have done, but they couldn't do it. And they went to this non-standard, very unusual way. And it scares the heck out of most people because printing money, everyone thinks, gives us runaway inflation. It hasn't. We've seen exactly the same thing functionally. So this is a very early stage of the cycle, which should go another 3 to 5 years, and earnings go up. We price stocks on earnings and interest rates, not on GDP.
What's the fundamental difference here? Is it that
Michael is a
deficit hawk and you're not? Michael seems to be, if you follow his argument down, he's really concerned about that federal deficit and that kind of eating away
I think we're all going to be surprised on the deficit. It's not going to be what we want it to be, but it's going to be a lot better and good enough. So we don't have the kind
Alan,
of thing.
He's going
to have to. You're going to have to control this guy, so he lets me talk.
Michael, what
and
do
then
you
I
say?
Will let him talk.
Yeah, Michael, what's your question there?
Well, I mean, first of all, deficits are still rising faster than nominal GDP. So the debt to GDP ratio is still rising.
But they're coming down, Michael. You got to look at the latest
data. Coming
the deficits
down.
Are coming down as a ratio of nominal GDP. And what happens when you have an upcycle, which lags the financial stimulus, is you're going to get surprises on the receipt side, which we are now seeing. Receipts will come in better than expected. GDP will grow faster, and the ratio will come down. We're not going to cure the structural deficits, but it is moving in the right direction. So you got to be forward-looking about the stock market. So
Michael, manageable there, Michael?
Not at all. So the deficit's still going to be, as I mentioned before, for fiscal 2013, about $850 billion. That is with quantitative easing, $85 billion every month, as far as the eye can see. When that crutch is removed, would you or would you not assume that the deficits would then return and face north instead of heading south?
Alan, how about that?
No, I don't think I would assume that at all, which is part of the reason why I'm probably more optimistic than you are. We actually are making progress in Washington on these awful deficits we have put in the can in a clownish way. $2.8 trillion of deficit reduction over 10 years, including this idiotic sequester and the way we did that. We have raised taxes, very controversial, and they are, in their way, dealing with some of the entitlements, Social Security problems, and each protagonist in our way we do business in government in Washington, which is appalling, it really has put cards on the table that talk about more deficit reduction. So it is in process, and it's happening now in the data, at least as we track the data. So it's not as dire as you point out, Michael.
Well,
you
want to take a good look at that. I just can't take a victory lap over a deficit on an annual basis of $850 billion. But Alan seems to almost be quiescent in his view that the Fed is doing something that they've done many times in the past. But when has a central bank on planet Earth ever unwound a $4 trillion balance sheet without any repercussions?
We see that's a challenge. Let me ask you about something that may have some, you know, just regular and even small-time investors worried on that front. Trying to do something for retirement, let's say. They've got to put money somewhere. If they don't want it under their mattress or in a savings account where it's making nothing, they may be in bonds. They may have retreated there after the crash to bonds. But a lot of people are talking about big danger for people who are sitting in bonds now, Michael. What is that danger?
Well, I wrote a book about it. First of all, it's the most overpriced, overowned, oversupplied market in the history of global economics. The 10-year note is now 550 basis points below its 40-year average.
So if somebody just sits in 10-year notes, let's say, for the next couple of years or 5 years, what's the risk? What are the people think of bonds as a no-lose proposition?
Well, first of all, they're not sitting in – most people own bond funds,
right,
which never mature. So they're going to get absolutely wiped out just as they did in the housing market and the NASDAQ bubble, both of which I called. I was on national television all throughout 2006 being eviscerated and excoriated.
But speak to our listeners
right
now
about the housing bubble,
right,
sort of like I'm being looked at today for writing a book about the coming bond market.
Oh, I don't think so. I hear a lot of people saying this. So if people are sitting in bonds
right now,
why
are the flows into bond funds still very, very high?
Well, that's why we're talking about this right now. I think it's because ordinary people are still freaked out by the stock market. They don't want to go back there. They don't know where to go. But what kind of losses could they take? Are you saying it's going to be like the housing market you're talking about?
Well, if the interest rates normalized, you'd go back to where they were, 7.3% going back to 1970, they'll lose about 25% to 30% of their portfolio in fixed income funds.
I mean, that sounds pretty wretched. I can imagine, Alan, that driving people to the stock. That's why we're talking about this today. Because this is people's retirement and their dreams on the line.
Michael, I agree with you. You've made a very good case for shifting out of fixed income at this point into stocks. And of course, if people are afraid of the stock market, what we've seen in the defensive stocks responding so well early in what's going to be a long expansion, we've seen them go there, and those stocks have done the best because they are moving out of fixed income into that, and they should accelerate that move.
They're looking for proxies.
We are solidly underweight asset allocation-wise and fixed income, because when those rates go up, I don't think they're going to go up quite the way Michael says, but still, they go up, you lose principal, and that wipes out any return. And the advice would be, can't go to cash and equivalent. The returns are zero there. So you really go to stocks, which is the reason to be overweighted in stocks and to move into stocks. And that's part of what's driving the stock market up.
Freaked out about doing that. Let me get our callers in here. Jessica in Mount Vernon, Kentucky. Jessica, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I'm concerned. I'm very concerned I'm like everybody else, I want to be happy that the stock market is climbing as high as it is. But on the other hand, I have to take in everything, not just economics. I have to also take in politics. I have to take in the global situation, everything, even the day-to-day grocery shopping as a housewife myself, you know.
So do you have the nerve, do you have the courage to be in the stock market now, or does it still scare you, Jessica?
To tell you the truth, it scares the living daylights out of me. I really don't believe that in the end, I think it's a bubble. It's going to pop, and I think that neither gold nor silver will save us in the end. In the end, Lord only knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, but what you
I'm a scared American citizen.
We hear it loud and clear. A lot of people in just that, they don't know what to do, but you've got to do something because, you know, who's got a retirement paid by the company anymore? So if you want to, we're supposed to live, you've got to have something to eat during those years. Erica in Beaufort, South Carolina. Erica, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. We're concerned about high-frequency trading making the stock market more like gaming than actual investing in real companies.
Yeah, a lot of people worried about that. Michael, how about it? In the comments coming in online, many, many people saying, look, this is a game for big boys now, and it's all set up to just, you know, stick it in the ear of the little guy.
The poor individual investor got burned in 2000 with NASDAQ, then the housing bubble, then the flash crash, and now they're sequestered in bond funds, and they're going to get hurt again. So, you know, they're looking for a proxy for bonds into the stock market, and that's why the leadership in the stock market is utilities and healthcare.
But you say go to the stock market and you're in trouble too, so where does that leave the little guy?
Say again, I'm sorry?
You're saying go to the stock market and you're also in trouble. So what's someone supposed to do?
You can't do a modern portfolio theory of investing. I run two funds. One is an inflation-deflation hedged portfolio. You have to be actively managed. And when the money supply is growing, you want to be more hedged towards inflation. And when the Fed and the Treasury step out of their debt monetizations, you want to be sequestered more into cash and short the market. So that's what I have. You have to be an actively hedged investor.
Actively hedged. That sounds like a high bar for a lot of people. Jeff in Boston is calling. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes, there's 2 points I wanted to make. One, the gentleman that just spoke, I believe his name's Mike, is making a valid point that I see what we're finding here is what they found after the first Great Depression, which is the stock market is not for the faint of heart and it's not for the uneducated. And really the advent of the E-Trades of the world that came about, I mean, this is the downfall of them. You get uneducated investors coming in just pouring cash into a market and then getting wiped out because they don't know when and where to shift their money. People are putting money into bond funds because they don't know any better. Traditionally, it's been hammered home for the better part of 50 years that bonds are safe.
Right.
Bonds are safe. Just buy bonds. And so they have no other knowledge. And that's really where I think moving away from the managing your portfolio yourself and going to more of a managed service from a bank or an investment house is going to really is really where we need to be focusing our efforts on educating the populace right now.
Jeff,
the other item I have is a question for the panel, and that is, how do they feel? The information came out for last year and this year, and we're at yet another record high for CEO pay by the average employee's income as far as the disparity there, and how they feel that difference is really weighing down on the economy. We haven't had a significant increase in the average wage earnings for an employee, yet CEO pay is at an all-time high.
Jeff, they're both great points. Forgive me, but our time is short here. Alan Sinai, take that on. People, they're afraid to go out there. They're not many people sophisticated investors. Actively hedge. I mean, you have to go to a dictionary just to begin. And then, you know, maybe it's about overall income and inequality as much as savings. But what happens if Americans don't get into something with a decent return year out?
Over many, many years, the capital markets have inherent returns. They go up, they go down. We had a decade we had no return on the S&P 500 in this country for 10 years. We now have a decade where we're going to have a decent positive return. Some portion, depending on the appetite for risk or the fear factor, needs to be in stocks. Good companies, solid stocks. That's what Mr. Buffett would say. That's what Jeremy Siegel of Wharton would say. That's what I would say. We've been around a long time. Or you can get scared and stay in cash where there's no return. I think you have to have some allocated there. On the CEO compensation, the listener has a very good point. From a public policy point of view, I would raise taxes and have a special tax on the gains in restricted stock and stock options that the CEOs are getting as they maximize shareholder value in their companies because they don't hire workers because of that.
Michael Pinto, in a word, where are you pointing people who are looking for some return? If it's not bonds and it's not the stock market, where, Michael?
No, I may be 100% clear. I am investing in the stock market. I'm buying dividend-yielding companies. But I am very nervous, and I've got an actively managed fund with one foot ready to jump out the door.
Michael Pinto with Pinto Portfolio Strategies in New York. Michael, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
And Alan Sinai, President and Chief Global Economist at Decision Economics. It's always great to see you, Alan.
Always great to see you, Tom.
We're going to take a minute to look at Angelina Jolie's decision to go for a double mastectomy, maybe to save her life. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Angelina Jolie is making headlines today, but not for the usual reasons. The 37-year-old actress and activist revealed today in a New York Times op-ed essay that she has had a double mastectomy within the last few months. Jolie writes in the Times that she made the decision after learning she has a faulty gene that gave her a very high risk of developing breast and or ovarian cancer. Jolie has 6 children and lost her own mother to cancer. She writes, "Now I can tell my children that they don't need to fear they will lose me to breast cancer." Have you faced the same decision? What do you think of Angelina Jolie's decision, and does it raise questions for you? Joining me now from Boston is Dr. Judy Garber, breast oncologist and director of the Center for Cancer Genetics and Prevention at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Garber, Judy Garber, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. So here's Angelina Jolie. She's 37. Her mother died of cancer at 56. She says doctors had estimated that she had an 87% risk of breast cancer and a 50% risk of ovarian cancer because she had the genetic profile that would put her in that category. What do you think of that assessment, and what do you think of her decision to go for a double mastectomy, doctor?
Well, I think that the figures that she gives are certainly within the range that we use for women who have a BRCA1 mutation, an alteration in that gene, and similar figures for the BRCA2 gene, and these are the most common genes associated with a family risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And I'm afraid that at this time in history, one of the main options for managing that kind of risk is surgery.
Can you explain the genetic risk here? What's the BRCA1? What's BRCA2? What does that mean, and what kind of risk does it raise for women, for breast cancer, for ovarian? They both seem to be here.
They are both there. So it's almost 20 years now that we've known about the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, two genes that, when inherited in a faulty way, as you said, or an altered way, can give people a risk of breast and ovarian cancers that's much higher than the general population. And in 20 years, we've studied as a community hundreds of thousands of people who now know that they have these genes and know that they have increased risk of breast and ovarian cancer. The gene test is a blood test, so it's a pretty easy test to have. But what's not so easy is the decisions about what to do once you know you do carry that risk.
Does a history of breast cancer in a family mean that a person's likely to be carrying this BRCA1 or 2?
Oh, no. So, I mean, certainly having family history is one of the ways people would recognize that they might have the risk. But breast cancer in particular is very common in our society, and most people's family history of breast cancer does not reflect the presence of a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. Most people have some family history and some maybe familial component, but much less powerful.
Do doctors tend to test for these genetic mutations as a standard procedure, or do you have to pay extra? How do you learn about this?
Well, I think most patients and women and some men, of course, and doctors recognize that there might be a BRCA1 or 2 mutation in the family, particularly when there's been very young ages at breast or ovarian cancer diagnosis, when there are multiple cancers in the family, breast and ovarian cancer in particular, when a man has had breast cancer, which happens.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it's only a minority that will have this gene, but if you have it, then you have to do something more about it, so doctors are looking for it now.
Well, what are the options then for patients or people like Angelina Jolie who do carry this genetic situation?
So the first is recognizing that the risk is higher, and so for breast cancer risk, women generally have more aggressive screening, so they start mammograms in their 20s, and they start annual breast MRI in their 20s, and regular examinations. And then for particularly women with a BRCA1 mutation, women do begin to think about surgery. Not all women will choose to have surgery, certainly, but some women will decide that it's too burdensome to live with the anxiety. On the ovary side, we have a different problem because we don't have any effective early detection. And we know that although people much more often survive their breast cancers, they don't survive their ovarian cancers as much, so their surgery is almost required, and that's a tough thing to face in young women.
You talk about anxiety that comes with this, but Angelina Jolie writes in a very straightforward way, saying, "My doctors estimated I had an 87% risk of breast cancer." That's more than anxiety. Those are odds that nobody would want to live with.
You're so right. I think, you know, it's amazing how differently people cope with this knowledge. And when in their lives people want to take control of the situation and say, okay, you know, this is what I have, this is what I'm going to do about it, or now is not the time. You know, you can find out you have this gene at any point. If you're 25, you want to have your children, you want to do things in your life. You may not have a partner yet. Surgery may not be the way to go at that moment. Later in your life, different options suddenly become more reasonable. And Angelina was able to choose when she was going to be tested and then what she was going to do. And we hope everybody should have that kind of access and that kind of power.
She suggests in her essay today in the New York Times that she will go on to have her ovaries removed as well. But a double mastectomy already has taken place for Angelina Jolie. And because of her super high exposure as a superstar, as a, for that matter, as a sex symbol, as a, you know, that's been part of her public image. This is really getting people's attention. Dr. Judy Garber is with us, breast oncologist. And Judy, we've got people calling in. Let me get take one of these calls here from Barbara in Boston. Barbara, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Garber. It's Barbara Litton-Cutler. Dr. Garber happens to be one of my, is my physician as well.
Great.
And, I just want to say that I think the fact that Angelina Jolie is open up and talking about this is wonderful, because she's an activist to begin with, and it makes people aware that not everybody can have this. I myself was found out about the gene about 5 years ago. I had my ovaries removed because that definitely decreases your risk for a few years. And I chose to do that too while I contemplated having my PBM, prophylactic breast
mastectomy.
And I'm still in the process of looking at that option, but I'm getting closer to it. And I think just the fact that she's going to be talking about it will help people sort of, like as you said, bring it out in the forefront and let people know that everybody... It can hit anybody, and it's not an odd choice to make.
Barbara, how do you think about it? I mean, here she is. Everybody knows she's got her own children. She's adopted a lot of children, and she's 37. She's in your age cohort. She's done it. How have you been weighing this and whether or not to go forward?
Well, that's it. I'm 39. I think I always... I have a huge, large history. My grandmother had breast cancer in both her breasts, but she managed to survive. My mother, we knew, had the gene because she was part of a research study many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I had cousins that have the gene and have lost their breasts. I lost a great aunt, so I've got this huge history. And then recently, I had a close friend last year pass away and leave two children, so it's kind of pushed me a little more towards probably getting this done in the near future as well.
Barbara, we wish you really good luck with it, and I'm grateful for your call right here. Thank you very much for that. Judy Garber, Dr. Garber, talk about how mastectomy itself has evolved, has come along. How is it like and unlike it was, I don't know, 20 years ago today?
Well, I think that's an important thing, Tom, that the surgery has gotten better. It's still major surgery.
Yes.
But... women these days often keep the nipple, which gives them from the outside a much more natural appearance.
Angelina Jolie suggests in her essay that she did that.
I think she looked like she worked hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the materials that are used to substitute for the original breast tissue is more natural and has finally been proven to be safe. There are procedures that where women can use their own tissue. It's absolutely still a big deal, but I think at the end, women hopefully will feel more beautiful, less mutilated. You know, this is something that people definitely have strong feelings about, but the surgery has improved. And not that we mean to push everyone to have surgery,
mm-hmm.
but for those people who make that choice, it's nice to have better options.
Angelina Jolie writes, 9 weeks later, the final surgery is completed with the reconstruction of the breast with an implant. There have been many advances, she writes, in this procedure in the last few years, and says this Hollywood actress, the results can be beautiful. Pav is calling from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Hi, Pav, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was actually sort of echoing what your previous caller had said. I'm BRCA1 positive as well and a breast cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really great to see someone with such a high profile come out and discuss this openly, because I think despite the increase in knowledge that we have in this area, there's just so much that so many people still don't know about it. I am a nurse. I work in women's healthcare. And even before my diagnosis, I was really horrendously ignorant of the subject. I didn't know as much as I should have.
Yeah.
So I'm just so glad it's getting, you know, such a high profile now.
When you, in your case, are the women that you deal with as a nurse in this area, Pav, where do you see women hesitating? Is it because, is it, you know, they just don't want to have the surgery? Is it a cosmetic thing? Is it about relationships? I mean, if they're facing a risk like this, what holds them back?
Well, I tend to see two different reactions. One is sort of the branch I took, which is I want to know everything about it and I want to do everything I can to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
The other is my cousin who has refused to even speak with me about it. And she runs the same risk I do. And she doesn't want to know about it. She doesn't want to talk about it. I think it can be very frightening to contemplate, you know, having an 87% breast cancer risk. And, you know, well, then if I know, then I have to make a decision, you know, and what would that be?
I suppose it's easier if you've had your children, if you're done with, let's say, breastfeeding, if you have your relationship, a sort of settled relationship. Angelina Jolie writes, she says, you know, she's fortunate to have this partner, Brad Pitt, who she writes is so loving and supportive. She says to anyone who has a wife or girlfriend going through this, know that you are a very important part of the transition.
Yeah, I feel very blessed. There's a wonderful community, the FORCE community, which stands for Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered, which was founded for and about people with the BRCA mutations. And I was so lucky to have that support, and
yeah.
I have a wonderful husband. I was 43 at the time of my diagnosis and had already had my children, and I've had tremendous family support and support from my friends. But I do think those decisions are a lot easier if you've had cancer. I think it must be harder for the people who have not had that and are weighing those risks.
And they're thinking, maybe the odds will break their way.
Maybe I would be in that 13%. Maybe I would never get it.
Yeah. No, we'll look at that. Pav, I so appreciate your call. One more right here from York, Pennsylvania. Laura's calling. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have the BRCA1 gene mutation.
Yes.
I found out about it last September.
Mm-hmm.
When I was on my 32nd day of 33 radiation treatments for breast cancer.
Wow, okay.
And I had a double mastectomy and reconstruction done 7 weeks ago.
7 weeks ago. How's it going, Laura?
It's going great, thank you.
I mean, you're still, I don't know, it's still, you're still in a sort of tender zone there, right? You're still in recovery.
Yes, but much less tender than I was 7 weeks ago, let's put it that way.
And what do you think of Angelina Jolie jumping out entirely in front of this? She doesn't have, as far as we know, there's no breast cancer diagnosis, just that risk. What do you think about her decision to do that?
Well, I think that it's hard to know what you'd do in somebody else's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sister who has ovarian cancer right now, and then when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, it was her doctor who suggested we get both tested for the BRCA gene.
Mm-hmm.
We both have it, and our third sister does as well. With all that, even if I hadn't had breast cancer, I probably would have gotten the mastectomy anyway.
Right.
But I'm 55.
Yeah.
I've had my children.
Yeah.
I don't need my uterus and ovaries anymore. I had those removed 2 weeks after I got the diagnosis, the BRCA diagnosis.
Yep.
And I have a very supportive husband who said, you need to do what's going to make you be the most comfortable.
Well, and the most healthy. And we wish you very, very good luck with that. Laura, I appreciate your call from Pennsylvania there. Judy Garber, what do you hear in these stories from our callers coming in?
Well, I think we can't help but be impressed by the tremendous strength that we hear from these callers, that they have struggled, but they have triumphed, and they've been able to take control, and that's largely what we want. I think it's, in some ways, it's even harder for people, as you pointed out, who have not had a cancer diagnosis, and some people who really don't have a family history that's as compelling as these women. They've been preparing in some way for this for some time, and some people find out only when they are themselves diagnosed or a close family member. And I think that we shouldn't forget this is a genetic condition, and one of the most difficult struggles for people is that they stand to pass this on. Not that they meant to, but that's
just the way it is. Yep.
But that's why, you know, we all continue to work to make their options better.
Angelina Jolie writes that the cost of testing for this genetic condition is more than $3,000 typically in the United States, and that's an obstacle for many women. What about the cost of testing, the cost of the surgery itself, to do it preventively? First, is the testing covered by insurance, if people have it? Is the preventive mastectomy covered by insurance, if people have it?
So the cost of testing is covered at least partially by most insurance, and that includes, in certain circumstances, even public insurances like Medicaid or Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
But often there are specific criteria that people have to meet. They have to have certain family history or personal history. The risk, the chance of finding a positive result, I guess, has to be high enough for the insurance company. And often there's still a substantial copay on a $3,000 test. So this is not a test everybody can just run in and get. And secondly, the surgeries, and this is the breast and the ovarian surgery, are generally covered by insurance, which, you know, once you've got the mutation in hand, then the insurance companies, I think, have realized that it's far less expensive to pay for prevention than for cure. But, you know, that's still also not always with all options available.
Judy Garber, breast oncologist, director of the Center for Cancer Genetics and Prevention at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Judy, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Angelina Jolie writing today in the New York Times in regard to her double mastectomy after her already huge career in film. She writes, "Life comes with many challenges. The ones that should not scare us are the ones we can take on and take control of." Thanks to Dr. Judy Garber for joining us there today. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter as well at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.